Okay, so we're going to start with lesson six today, a passion for people. And I appreciate in your prayer, Matt, that you mentioned that when we see people, slipping, and that we don't just turn a blind eye to that we learn how to develop a passion for people and their, and what they're going through and ways that we can reach out to them and help them. So the lesson is based out of 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. Paul's prayer about his relationship with the Thessalonian church and the situation that he found himself in when he abruptly had to leave this young fledgling church that he didn't feel like he had covered all of his bases, and he was very anxious and worried about them. And his prayer is kind of wrapped around that idea that, he wanted, when Timothy reports back to them that they were doing well, he's overfilled with joy. So I want to kind of look into that idea of Paul. When he goes to these cities all through the book of Acts, he travels all over on his three missionary journeys, and he goes to these cities, and, when he has a passion for people, obviously his passion was to try to convert people to Christ. But if somebody wants to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, we're going to read a few verses there. I mean, Paul tells us when he goes into a new city, his mindset of how he looks for doors, looks for opportunities to be able to teach different people. And Dave, do you mind reading verse 20 through 22?
Mm-hmm. To the Jews, I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some.
And in Acts chapter 17, Paul says, in verse 22 through 30, then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing him, I proclaim to you, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, since he gives life to all, breath and in all things. So in those verses, we're all very familiar with it. It gives us some real insight into when Paul goes into a city, what does he do?
He tries to be like those people.
Right. He tries to see, look for opportunities, look for doors. Okay, this fellow I meet, I have this in common with him, and I can try to relate to him and reach him in this way. And this, you know, and when he goes to Athens and he sees that there are religious people, that there's his first stop. Okay, this is something I can cover common ground with them about and teach them about Christ. So we all understand if you're in sales, I mean, that's what you do. You look for opportunities to create a conversation, create an opportunity to begin a relationship. Everybody's read probably To Kill a Mockingbird, and one of the lines in it says, you'll never really understand another person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb inside of his skin and walk around it. So, I mean, in essence, that's what Paul does. He goes into these cities, and he becomes a Jew. He becomes a Roman. He becomes a Greek. Whatever he needs to do to be able to converse with people about Christ. He has a compassion and an empathy to understand and share in their feelings and the way they think about things, and he tries to discuss things with them and relate to them in a way that is influential to them. So basically, he converted people by listening to them, befriending them, and providing spiritual guidance on things that they needed to learn about. And in turn, just like we're going to read about his relationship with the Thessalonians, he becomes deeply attached to these people that become Christians and has anxiety for their well-being, that he prays nonstop for all of these different churches that he has established throughout on his missionary journeys. And so, you know, you can read in Romans, Brad, you mind reading Romans chapter 9, verses 2 through 3? These next couple of verses we'll read just gives us some insight into the emotions that Paul felt for the people that he converted.
9, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
It says that I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart, or I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh.
So what's that verse tell you about Paul, friend?
Well, he's asking to be trade places with them, basically.
Yeah, he has such a deep care and concern and passion for people that he would give up his place for them. And in Romans 10, and I forgot to write down the verse, but it says, brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they may be saved. Matt, do you mind reading 2 Corinthians 11, 28?
Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all of the churches.
So, I mean, think about that weight that he had on him. I mean, the elders here, not to demean or belittle the weight that they carry, but this is one congregation, and it's more than they want, more than they can bear sometimes, sure, at some point, even though they do their best. But Paul had these congregations scattered all throughout everywhere he went that he just was concerned about and worried about not just the congregation as a whole, but every individual that he came in contact with was deeply concerned for their soul, for their well-being, and was in constant prayer for their well-being.
Right.
Yes.
I think that doesn't necessarily come naturally either.
No, I was going
to... We all care for people. I mean, you've heard people say, well, I don't like people. And we understand that. They're either shy or bashful or backward or, you know, they're not the person that goes up and says, hi, my name is Brian Whiteside. They're not that person, you know, because they're intimidated, they're scared to do that. Any of us are like that at times, or sometimes all the time. But Paul, I mean, think about it from our standpoint. When you go through something, you can have more empathy for somebody else. You can, what you're talking about, you know, being in their skin or walking in their shoes. When you've gone through something, you understand when somebody else is going through that. I had a friend of mine who, he was a preacher, and he used to go and talk with people who were terminally ill, that had terminal cancers a lot. And he thought he did a good job in his talking with them, but then he figured out that he didn't once he got cancer. And he was a survivor of that, and he said it made him a better person when he went to do that, because he could understand where they were coming from. You know, he understood better where they were. And we're like that too. Each one of us has something different that we've dealt with. That's, you know, mine's going to be different from yours. Yours is going to be different from mine. Yours is going to be different from Jennifer's. And so around the room. But that helps us to be able, and that's difficult at times, trying to, you know, when Clint talked about it was hard when he went to the funeral home to know what to say. Those are hard things to know what to say. It's hard, you know, when you visit the hospital to know exactly what to say, or, you know, to want to say the right thing, or, and those are hard things. You know, I was called to the hospital one time to pray for someone who was dying. I'm going to tell you, that's a hard prayer to pray. I mean, they were faithful Christians, so in that respect, that is not a hard prayer. But that is a difficult time to want to say the right things and to pray the right things. Sometimes those are those things that, you know, we don't know exactly what to say.
And I was going to open it up for discussion if you guys don't mind sharing. You know, like you said, some people aren't naturally compassionate or empathetic to other people's feelings. But those are things that we can develop, and you can change those things. Anybody think of an example, even in your own life, or something that you know where you've changed to be more understanding towards something, and or you've learned to develop something that didn't come naturally to you? Awesome. You guys are better than me. I mean, I don't have an example either, but I know that as a Christian, just reading the scriptures and learning and seeing and watching and interacting with all you guys and seeing the things that different members of this congregation goes through gives you more insight and more understanding and helps you to be more, and simple fact of prayer itself, when you're in the act of prayer for another person, that's an act of self, or serving others before yourself. I mean, you're thinking about their needs, and the more you practice that, the more empathetic and compassionate of a person I believe you'll become. Do you guys think that's a fair statement? I mean, the more you put other people in prayers, you're putting their needs before your own. So I want to back up a little bit and think of, and just give a little bit of brief history of the Thessalonican church and how Paul ended up here and how he created this relationship with these people where he was so filled with anxiety over their well-being. So Thessalonica was a Roman province in Macedonia, the seat of the government and practically the capital of the whole province. There's a civil war between Caesar and Pompey, where Thessalonica took the senatorial side and formed one of Pompey's chief bases. But 6 years later, in the final struggle, they sided with Anthony and Octavian, and they were rewarded a status of a free city, which will come into play here in a little bit later on in the story. It was the most populous town in Macedonia and the biggest metropolis of the province, with a large import and export business. And also, and Paul made use of this, had the great Via Ignatia, the highway from the Adriatic to Hellespont. So he visited there several times. First time on his second missionary journey, he had been to Philippi and passed on through the Nation Road to Amphipolis and Apollonia in Acts chapter 17. When he got to Thessalonica, he found a synagogue of the Jews, even though it was primarily a Greek city. And he worshiped for 3 successful Sabbaths there. And based the message there on Old Testament scriptures. Some of the Jews became converts, and you'll remember the verse that says, considerable number of proselytes and Greeks and many women of high social status in Acts 17:4 obeyed. And then several members of that went on missionary journeys with him on his third missionary journey, Archacristus and Secundus, they were both from Thessalonica and became companions of Paul's on his missionary journeys in Acts 19 and 27. Also Gaius, which is mentioned in conjunction with Archacristus sometimes, was from Thessalonica. So how long he remained there on his first visit, we know it was at least 3 weeks, but most people think that it was probably longer, probably more about like 6 months. I didn't really find out why they thought that, but probably longer than the 3 weeks that is mentioned in Acts. We know that he was there at least long enough for the Philippian church to send him assistance on two occasions. So that probably wouldn't just happen in 3 weeks. And in chapter 2, verse 9, he says that he worked night and day. So he was there long enough to try to create his own, make his own way, even though he did receive assistance. But when he was there, he saw, because of the prosperity, the size of the city, everything that was going on, that it was an effective place to create a church and to try to reach out in the whole area of Macedonia. So what ends up happening to him there, though, in Acts chapter 17? He gets run out of the city by the Jews, and they come to the house of Jason, and the Jews start a big commotion. Paul's not there, but they drag Jason and some of the other converts before the magistrate, accuse them of trying to, just create uproar, chaos in the city. So they send them to Berea to escape the trouble from the Jews. But what ends up happening when they're in Berea? Who comes after them there? The Jews from Thessalonica. So they're not happy that they just ran them out of their city. They're so upset about all this that they're going to follow them to wherever Paul decides to go next. And Berea was, according to Cicero, a historian, that was just kind of a off-the-map, kind of podunk way. He called it a out-of-the-way town. So, I mean, Paul didn't just go down to the next biggest metropolis. He was kind of going out of the way, and they found him there and searched him out there and tried to cause trouble for him again. But he was obviously more fruitful there, because what was said of the Bereans?
They were honorable.
Yeah, they accepted his teachings and wanted to search it out for themselves to find out if what he was saying was correct. But again, he ends up having to leave there again because of the Thessalonican Jews, and he ends up in Athens, which was the second verse we read at the beginning, where, again, he uses his talents to observation and ways to make inroads with people to try to create ways to talk to people about Christ there. Just kind of as a side note, it's interesting, just as the historical accuracy of the book of Acts, even though we didn't discuss Philippi there, but if you compare Philippi with Thessalonica, because Philippi is discussed in Acts chapter 16, it talks about that city being military rather than commercial, whereas Thessalonica was a commercial city. There were few Jews there, no synagogues, but the magistrates there bear the name of praetors. And in any sort of court case, it was attended by lictors, where Paul and Silas are charged with the conduct and introduction of customs which Romans may not observe. In Philippi, they were beaten with rods. But when they get to Thessalonica, I talked about a minute ago that it was a free city. It was a Greek commercial city, and they enjoyed a certain amount of autonomy, even though it was part of the Roman Empire. They had their own constitution with a large resident Jewish community and a synagogue. But the charge there was that Paul was trying to replace Caesar by another king, and the writers wished to bring him before the people. So just the historical accuracy of when the book of Acts is written, that he, just the different cities and the way the different cities are set up to pass judgment about certain things, it wasn't just overlooked in the historical accuracy of it. I mean, it proves it in so much that that the city in the Thessalonica, the people that would pass judgment were called politarchs, and there's actual inscriptions in the British Museum that back up that fact that the historical accuracy of Acts is proven right there. And it's also interesting that that very inscription that they found on the gate of Thessalonica, at the Vadar Gate, has the names of Sosipater, Gaius, and Secundus, three of the men. I don't know if they're the same three men, but three men in that city that were part of being able to the six politarchs. All right, so enough of the history, kind of just giving you a little bit of backdrop of the city that Paul found himself in when he established this church. So when he ends up there, he establishes a church. It ends up being a strong and flourishing church. Like I said, composed mostly of Gentiles rather than Jews. And you'll notice from the two books that there's a kind of an absence of Paul quoting from Old Testament scriptures, where he does in a lot of his other books. And I think that can be pointed to the fact that this was a mostly Gentile congregation. And he says in 1 Thessalonians 1:9, "You turn them to God from idols." So, I mean, he's directly stating, you know, this congregation, this letter is written to a group of people that primarily came out of paganism. The book of 1 and 2 Thessalonians was probably one of Paul's first epistles, and he revisits the idea again over and over how he wants to visit there soon, and he's hindered by Satan once again, but he probably does end up visiting there at least three different times. So I want to look at, what do you, obviously we know that they were paganism, but does anybody know anything about anything that they observed as far as their spirituality in Thessalonica? Because this ended up being very interesting to me, and it actually played right into the story pretty well. Yeah, go ahead.
Brian, you mentioned verse 9, in 1 Thessalonians, the first chapter, verse 9. That verse 9 and 10 really are the key verses of 1 Thessalonians. And it's important, you know, that they turn, you know, we can read past that and say, well, you know, for they themselves report about us what kind of a reception we had with you, and how you turned to God from idols, and we can, you know, just ho-hum about that, how you turned to God from idols. And you go on, it says, to serve a living and true God. That's something totally different. So when we talk about having empathy for people and a care for people, Paul knew, you know, where had Paul come from? He'd been you know, he was, if we ranked sinners, he would have been the chief of, you know, he was one of the worst. So he knew, you know, his plight was, he didn't have any hope. They didn't either, because they were serving these pagan gods. And when they, the word serve in verse 9, one of the meanings of that is constantly. So when they turned to God, they were serving God constantly. There are other pagan gods, it was a hit or miss, you know, while they may serve them for a while, you know, there's no requirement. It's do what you want to do. Say what you want to say. But when they're serving God constantly, wasn't so with their other gods. But that's an important thing. That's one of the reasons Paul can relate to them so well, is, hey, they turned. You know, that's why the others were so mad at him. You know, that's why they're chasing after. You know, he's causing a stir here. He's changing these people, you know, because we've always done this way. You know, we've always, I mean, put ourselves in that position too. It's easy to do what we want to do. You know, it's a It's comforting to us to do what we want to do, whether that's right or wrong. We're all, you know, we're old enough to make right and wrong decisions every day. But when we choose to you know, when we choose, and I mean, we think about serving idols. I would venture to say nobody in here is bowing down to, when I think of idols, I think of little, you know, statues made of gold and things like that. I don't think any of us are guilty of bowing down to any idols, as I would call it. But what we do have idols, you know, those things, they can be a lot of different things. They can be family. They can be habits. They can be all kinds of things. You know, they can be our jobs, things like that. Those are our idols. Things that we, our own will can be our idol. But when we turn away from that, we're just like them. You know, we're turning away from idols to serve a living God. And that's a constant thing. That is involved in every decision and everything we do throughout our whole life until we're not here anymore. And we're just like them. And they're just like us. We just got cars. Yeah. And cell phones.
So if you're going to have a Bible study, with Mormon, and you knew it was next week, so you had a little bit of time, what would you do beforehand?
Probably just wing it.
Just joking. Okay, Casey,
study about what they believe.
Exactly. So, and that would be the case with no matter what denomination. You would try to be as informed as you possibly could before you went into any conversation, so you could you'd have a playing field that you might have a conversation. So I'm sure that Paul did that. When he went into Thessalonica, he went around just like he did in Athens and looked for things that he could make a conversation about. So I want to tell you a little bit about the cult that they were observing in Thessalonica, and you think about how Paul could have used this to his advantage. So Thessalonica, as we said, was a free city. It was divided by class, but it was an especially difficult city for poor people, even though it was a very bustling import and export town. So the pagan response to the powerlessness that many of these poor Thessalonians felt was a spiritual movement called the Cabrius cult. And it was founded by a guy named Cabrius, and he was somebody that spoke up for the disenfranchised poor people of the city. Eventually, he ended up being murdered by his two brothers, but he was buried with symbols of royalty, and the cult came to treat him as a martyred hero. And the lower class people believed that he had exhibited miraculous power while he was alive, and they believed that from time to time he would come back quietly and return to life to help individuals and return to bring justice to the lower class, restore the city to its past independence. They believed that the Cabrius cult provided hope for the oppressed in terms of giving them something out of their oppression. But they also believed that the worship included blood sacrifice to commemorate his martyrdom, and the Thessalonians spoke of participation in his blood. By this, they mean that obtaining relief from guilt, and the class distinctions would be abolished. So when Paul learned about that, what do you think he, and what they believed and what they followed, what do you think he was thinking? Could you replace Christ with Cabrius? A blood sacrifice that redeemed people of their guilt. I mean, all of these things that they had already in this wrong individual, he can interject Christ into that and be like, hey, here's a way that I can teach them what they're doing, have learned wrong, and a way that I can teach them right about Christ. And one further thing, that when the Romans put more interjection of their power into Thessalonica, the emperor cult rose and kind of replaced the cult of Cabrius, and the Romans decreed that Cabrius had already come in the person of Caesar, so the occupying authority co-opted with the hope of the oppressed people of the city and made it where the existence of the emperor cult meant that anyone resembling Cabrius would be an immediate threat to the establishment. So the Romans kind of replaced the Thessalonican idea of the Cambrian cult with the emperor worship, which we know that all the Roman emperors needed to be worshipped. They believed that they were gods and had to be worshipped like that. So what kind of a spiritual vacuum was left when the Romans made Cabrus basically null and void. Paul took advantage of that. He said, okay, so now they can get in trouble if they don't worship the emperor when their old spiritual pagan god of Cabrus. They can't do that anymore because they can be it can be a threat to the establishment of they're not worshiping the emperor. So Paul took full advantage of that. He said, okay, there's a lot of similarities between things that they already think and believe. I can teach them about the one true God that laid down his own blood as a sacrifice, did come to save the oppressed, and did, you know, all the things that lined up with what they thought could be fulfilled in Christ. So the gospel, we understand, provides both the inner peace in the present and in the second coming, which was something that they were looking forward to as well. So when he creates this church, the verse we read, that they are pulled out of paganism, but he ended up having to leave. What do you think Paul's immediate concern is?
Where they would fall away.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when Clint made the list up here last week, I think Kelly may have said the idea of we pray for our new converts. Why is that? Because we all understand what the world is like outside of these four walls. And even for us, it's hard. So imagine being in a pagan city with these beliefs you've had, been taught probably all your life, and then this guy comes in and starts teaching you these new things, and you buy into it. Not that it's not true, but you take it in and you believe it. But then you're just getting started, and your leadership has to leave, and you're on your own to fend for themselves, not only to maintain your belief in your faith, but they're facing persecution from the outside for standing up for that faith. So, I mean, obviously he was concerned and worried for them, and that leads him into this prayer in chapter 3. You know, it had to have been an enormous temptation when you're already weak and young and in your faith to just go back. You know, I mean, we see it here in this congregation when people are converted. The pressures from the outside world just pull people back. And it can be easy to slip back into that. Paul's carrying a war right into the enemy's backyard. And then he has to leave. So we'll go ahead and we'll start, we'll read chapter 3 of 1 Thessalonians. Kelly, do you mind reading that? It's not very long.
Therefore, when we could bear it no longer, we were willing to be left behind at Athens alone, and we sent Timothy, our brother and God's co-worker in the gospel of Christ, to establish and exhort you in your faith, that no one be moved by these afflictions. For you yourselves know that we are destined for this. For when we were with you, we kept telling you beforehand that we were to suffer affliction, just as it has come to pass, and just as you know. For this reason, when I could bear it no longer, I sent to learn about your faith, for fear that somehow the tempter had tempted you and our labor would be in vain. But now that Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us the good news of your faith and love, reported that you always remember us kindly and long to see us, as we long to see you. For this reason, brothers, in all our distress and affliction, we have been comforted about you through your faith. For now we live, if you are standing fast in the Lord. For what thanksgiving can we return to God for you, for all the joy that we feel for your sake before our God, as we pray most earnestly night and day, that we may see you face to face and supply what is lacking in your faith. Now may our God, Father himself, and our Lord Jesus direct our way to you. And may the Lord make you increase and abound in love for one another and for all as we do for you, so that he may establish your hearts blameless in holiness before our God and Father at the coming of our Lord Jesus with all his saints.
Can you imagine what Paul felt like when Timothy came back to him and told him that they were all doing good? They were all there, they were faithful, and that they were flourishing. I mean, the weight that must have been lifted off his shoulders must have been enormous. I mean, you can put your own self in that situation, something that you've been so anxious and so worried about, and then when the good news finally comes, Angie, what do you feel like?
sorry, I was taking notes.
Okay, Angie wasn't paying attention. But I can tell you what Angie feels like. When she found out she was cancer-free, I mean, the weight from you, for you and your family, must have been more than you can even put into words. And that was something that I was thinking when we were on vacation and we found out that my mom's cancer was a lot worse than the doctors realized. I mean, I remember we were at the beach and I felt like I had been hit in the gut when Dad called and said that it was a lot worse and they didn't know what they were going to, you know, what was going to happen. And of course, Jennifer's trying to be like, it'll be all right. It's just, you know, it's not as bad as you always make things out to be. And what's ended up happening? In her case, too, God answered my prayer and you guys' prayer. And I mean, that kick in the gut has now turned to joy, just like Paul's feeling of something he was so anxious about and worried. And he turned it over to God in prayer, and God answered his prayer. And it created a joy in him that he couldn't even explain, that he was so happy. And he states in here that he had an intense longing to be with them. He missed them so much and had created such a close bond with these men and women that he just constantly longed to be with them, and they were constantly on his mind. And he considered them. You know, sometimes you read through this and you don't, or I don't really stop to think about the friendships Paul made with these people. You throw out these names in the book of Acts that Paul did this with this person, and Paul did this with this person. Well, there was probably a whole lot more interaction Paul had with that person in a friendship kind of way than you read in the one or two verse where a name's mentioned. And he constantly was thinking about them, praying for them, and just wanted to see them. And I just wanted us to think about our friendships that we have here and how valuable they are and how important it is for us to be and prayer for each other, and that we consider the friendships we have inside this building just our true friendships, and the most valuable assets that we have is to stick together and to pray for each other. And Paul felt that way about them. And in my mind, I always think about Paul as, I mean, he was an apostle, and he was able to do these things that sometimes I would think I would never be able to accomplish. But he was just a man, just like me and you. And to consider Paul your friend and that he's praying for me, that, you know, but think about that. Kelly, Dave, anybody can pray for you and can achieve the exact same result as what Paul did. And we just can't lose sight of that our prayers for each other are extremely powerful. I remember when they announced a couple weeks ago when Andrew's cancer-free, and the gasp of air Jennifer took in sitting next to me, Jules jumped off her chair, and it just was like, I was, you know, the joy that everybody in the congregation felt when that prayer was answered. And that's what our prayers can do for each other. And Paul had those friendships with this congregation. He considered them his brothers and sisters and his dearest friends. And he enjoyed their company and longed to be back with them. And I don't think that we have a problem with that here, that we all want to spend time together and enjoy getting together to go eat or do whatever. I know I'd rather be with you guys than anybody else I know in Bowling Green, and I'm sure you guys feel the same way about each other, that the friendships that we have are priceless, and they need to be cherished and taken care of. And Paul felt that way about this church. Now he says in verse 5, "For this reason I could no longer endure it. I sent to know your faith, lest by some means the tempter had tempted you and our labor might be in vain." What he's talking about, he could no longer endure it and he had to leave. You know, you can put the words taken away or torn away, kind of with the idea that they were orphaned from him, like his people that he helped so much and he cared for so much, he was taken away and he missed them dearly. So I wanted to just take a minute to think about our people in this congregation and their spiritual welfare and what we're doing. Because Brad talked about last week, you know, when you pray for someone, you better be prepared for the door to open and what you can do to meet that prayer. And that, you know, sometimes it's easy to just throw a prayer up on somebody's behalf and say, God, I hope they get you know, better spiritually. But what are you going to do to enable that, what you're asking God to do? So everybody write that phone number down or take a picture of it or whatever you want to do, because he's not in the directory any longer as of last week. That's Benjamin Owens. And he desperately needs you to contact him, because I've talked with him a couple times and he got withdrawn from it. I mean, that's no secret, but he hasn't lost his faith in God and he wants to get his life in order, and he needs our help badly. And he is someone that we can pray about and we can look for the door of opportunity. Even if he doesn't answer his phone, leave him a message so he knows that you called him. All of us, if we could just all do that, that's a way that you can pray and you can enable your part of it to try to pray for the spiritual well-being, like Paul did here, for this congregation, that he worried about them constantly. And I hope that we don't ever, when someone's withdrawn from, or someone, you know, there's others, Johnny Randolph. I mean, everybody's noticed that his attendance has been hit or miss lately. I mean, it's no secret. But what can we do to reach out to that person and not just say, "Oh, Johnny wasn't here again today," and then go to lunch? I mean, and I'm guilty of it. I'm not pointing the finger at anybody. I'm just saying we got to be thoughtful in prayer about it and not just ask for God to take care of that, or God to take care of that, but we got to be willing to bring it to God in prayer to show that we're empathetic and compassionate and thinking about them, but also willing to carry the heavy load of it if we're called to do it, to help those people. And those are just two examples. You guys could probably come up with a bunch of your own examples of different people that need encouragement and need our help. And that's what friends that love each other do. Paul would have done that for any of these members of Thessalonica, and that's just the point that I kind of want to emphasize, is how beloved they were to him, and that's how we should be with each other. Yeah, Dave?
I don't remember whenever it was, Travis said something that really stuck with me. A lot of times, you know, we're, like you and I, we're friends, but we're brothers also. And, you know, I mean, if one of our family members, something happens to one of our family members and they need our help, we're going to do whatever we can to make sure that their need is met, you know. And we need to view each other the same way. I mean, I'm closer to a lot of you all than a lot of my family, you know. And we need to show that we do care for each other and that we are important and that we're brothers and sisters and not just acquaintances that we see a few times a week, you know.
Absolutely. That's my point entirely.
Yeah.
We need to value what we have here, and I'm bad about it. I mean, I'm preaching to myself.
Yeah.
Brad?
One thing too, Brian, to remember, and it's always difficult to know what to say. You know, when somebody, let's say you've fallen away, and, you know, and I fail because I don't contact you or something like that because I don't know what to say to you. You know what? You don't have to contact you and say, "You need to be doing what's right." What if we contacted you and said, "You know, we miss you. We wish you were here." That's all. Because here's what you have to remember. And this is difficult for me to separate the sin from the sinner. It's very, very easy. And this is me. I hope I'm the only one that's like this. But I want to hate the person rather than the sin. Very easy for me to do that. And I really have to guard about that. But here's the thing I know. And there are people we've withdrawn from before, and that works. It works. I've seen it work. Sometimes it doesn't work. It doesn't, you know, bring them back. Here's the thing to remember. I never know of a case in my entire life, I've never talked to anybody that knew of a case where somebody was withdrawn from or somebody fell away and the world brought them back to our door and said, "Here, we're through with them. You all can have them back." I never know that happening. Now, the only things that I know of happening is people, members of the church, maybe in another state, another country, could, you know, across the street, they have interaction with that person and they reach them, or we do. We're the people that are going to bring them back. It's not the world that's going to bring them back to us and say, here, we're done. There you go. That's never going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, when I called Benjamin the day after he got withdrawn from, the very first thing I asked him was, how do you feel about what happened yesterday? And he said, I don't like it at all. I mean, it's bothering him, and we got to follow up on that. And I hate to keep harping on him, but like I said, that's our responsibility as friends to each other and as Christians to do that for him and to whoever else, because that's what friendships do, and I think that's what Paul had developed here with these people. Okay, thanks. So we'll finish up on Wednesday.
Need some help.